You know, some people are just naturally helpful. Don't you know somebody like that? Boy, I do. And here in the church, we have those people. And, you know, outside, beyond the church, I know people like that. It's, you know, if you're having a birthday party or an anniversary party or a wedding or a baby shower or something, there are certain people that you want to call and you want them to come and be there because they just have this natural ability to know what needs to be done and do it. And not only that, they enjoy it. They enjoy the helping. Some people just have that gift. In fact, in 1 Corinthians 12:28, helping or helps is listed along with several other spiritual gifts such as teaching and the gift of prophecy, the gift of healing, the gift of tongues and other things. So there is that sense where that innate desire to help is a spiritual gift. And I guess you could kind of paraphrase that old saying, some people are helpful all of the time and all of the people are helpful some of the time, you know? And it's only natural as believers that you want to be helpful when it comes to the kingdom too. We want to help our fellow believers experience all the blessings and benefits of salvation, and I think it's only right that it bothers us, it unsettles us if we see our brothers and sisters going the wrong way, making bad decisions. At the same time, we want to help unbelievers get a hold of the heart of the gospel. That is, that measuring up to a holy standard is not only impossible, it's not even what the Lord asks of us. That Jesus took the consequences for our flawed nature and gives the consequences of his perfect nature to anyone and everyone who believes in him. Now, the problem is that too often in our desire to help, we come on a little too strong. You know what I mean? If you haven't done it, you've had it done to you, or you've seen it done. We sometimes, believers, sometimes hold one another to a standard that the Lord never intended. And we find ourselves jumping to conclusions about who really belongs to him and who really doesn't. Now, we've been studying Matthew's account of the Sermon on the Mount, that time early in the second year of his ministry when Jesus took his closest followers aside and said to them, in effect, this is what I want you to know. Now, in chapter 5, he taught about the character of the kingdom, those inner character qualities, and some have called that chapter the pathway to happiness, because he says, happy are, or blessed are those. Then in chapter 6, he taught about the results of righteousness, the inner changes that take place in the lives of a believer, and some have labeled that the highway to holiness, the pathway to happiness, and then the highway to holiness. Now in chapter 7, the third and final chapter of this Sermon on the Mount passage, Jesus begins to teach about right relationships. First, it's the inner attitudes, you know, the character of the kingdom. Then it's the results of righteousness in our own hearts. And then it's right relationships as these interchanges work their way to the outside. And some have called this passage the freeway of faith. If you're a truck driver, I think you really especially get that, the pathway to happiness, the highway to holiness, and the freeway of faith. Now, in Matthew chapter 7, in the first 6 verses, Jesus says to his people, I think that not only includes those that were there at that time, but that also includes his people here and now, anywhere and everywhere that belong to him. He says, I want you to know that it's not your job to judge one another, to judge anyone. It's not your job to judge. Let's start reading in Matthew 7, verse 1. Judge not that you be not judged. Now that is an awkward tangle of words to my little hillbilly brain. that you be not. How about judge not so that you won't be judged? Is that a little simpler? For with what judgment you judge, you will be judged. And with the measure you use, it will be measured back to you. And why do you look at the speck in your brother's eye, but don't consider the plank in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, let me remove the speck from your eye, and look, a plank is in your own eye? You hypocrite. First, remove the plank from your own eye, and then you'll see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. Don't give what's holy to the dogs, nor cast your pearls before swine, lest they trample them under their feet and turn and tear you to pieces. It's not your job to judge, first of all, because we're not called to or qualified to judge one another. We're not called to judge. We're not qualified to judge. Right in the first two words, judge not. Now, let me tell you what that doesn't mean. It doesn't mean check your brain at the door. There are several places where the Bible tells us clearly to be discerning. Romans 16:17, just jot that reference down and I'll read the verse for you, where Paul wrote, I urge you, brothers, to watch out for those who cause divisions and put obstacles in your way that are contrary to the teaching you have learned. Keep away from them. When he says watch out, that in a sense is a judgment. He's telling us, you know, to make a distinction. You know, be discerning. Watch out. And Galatians 1:8, a similar point where Paul writes, even if we or an angel from heaven should preach a gospel other than the one we preach to you, let him be eternally condemned. When he says, even if we or an angel should preach, so forth and so on, he implies that we are to assess or recognize the difference between the true gospel and a twisted gospel. Now, in a sense, that's a form of judgment, isn't it? To judge between the false gospel, the real gospel, to judge those who put obstacles in our way contrary to the teaching of the gospel. See, obviously, there is a need to judge for identification, to identify, to recognize, to discern, to assess. But we are not called or qualified to judge for condemnation. Identification, yeah, but not condemnation. And where that comes from, this very word, judge, judge not that you not that you be not judged. It's a Greek word, krino, and it literally can be translated into separate, do not separate. It has to do with looking at a pile of stuff or whatever, and you divide it, you separate it. And it's exactly what we read about in Matthew 25. In fact, let's turn up there to Matthew 25, where Jesus is talking about here the end of time, and there's going to be a separation. And it's the same idea, verse Matthew 25, 31. When the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the holy angels with him, then he will sit on the throne of heaven. All the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate. He will judge them one from another, as a shepherd divides his sheep from the goats. And he'll set the sheep on his right hand, but the goats on his left hand. Then the king will say to those on his right hand, come, you blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. And jump down to verse 41. And he will say to those on his left hand, depart from me, you cursed, into the everlasting fire prepared for the devil and his angels. See, that kind of separation, that kind of judgment, like the sheep and the goats, that's a kind of judgment only the Lord can make. Only the Lord is qualified to make. And we're not only not qualified to make those kind of judgments, but he doesn't ask us to. He doesn't call us to make those kind of judgments. You know, it's always the case when I'm invited to do a memorial service for someone who is not necessarily a church attender, and they're not a Bible reader, and they're not a person of prayer, and they're, you know, from the outside, you can't really see or discern any sort of spiritual connection with the Lord at all. And of course, the family wants reassurance that their loved one is in heaven. And You know, when they are, it's easy to say, yes, they are. And when they're not, you got to be careful, you know, to what you say. But the point is, you don't really know. Because there are going to be those people who are the last people you would expect are going to be standing there smiling at the door to heaven to welcome you in. You're going to say, what? I never expected to see you here. And then there's going to be those people where you look around, you just know they're going to be there, and they're not there. And then you go, well, what happened to so-and-so? Oh, they didn't make it. They were one of those people where the Lord looked at him and said, I never knew you. We can't tell. You can't tell from the outside in where someone stands with the Lord. And because we're not qualified to make that decision, we're not called to make that decision. And when he says, judge not, he says, you know, don't do that. Don't judge people, because you can't. You really can't. We're told to make an identification, but never a condemnation. Right in this same chapter in Matthew 7, down in verse 16, and we're going to cover this verse in depth in a few weeks, but he says, you will know them by their fruits. Do men gather grapes from thorn bushes or figs from thistles? And the point of all that is, you don't judge the person, you judge the fruit. Some people, I suppose, can tell the difference between an apple tree and a pear tree by looking at the leaves or the branches or the, you know, but I can't. Most of us can't. How do you tell an apple tree from a pear tree? You wait until harvest time and see what kind of fruit grows on it. Apples grow on apple trees and pears grow on pear trees. He says, you wait and for the fruit. You look at the fruit of their lives. And even then, that's for that discernment of identification, not condemnation. This warning has to do really with judging motives and the inner man. See, I can only see what you do. You can only see what I do. But I don't know your motives, and you don't know mine. In fact, I got to tell you, one of the most hurtful things that can ever happen is when someone questions your motives. I mean, you might make a mistake. You might do something you wish you hadn't done. You might say something that you wish you had said differently or maybe not said at all. And then it gets stirred up into this kind of tornado of misunderstanding. And, you know, and that's going to happen in life. But when someone questions your motives, you know, that you meant to do evil or you meant to cause harm, that can be one of the most hurtful things that can ever happen to us. And that's another reason the Lord warns us. You know, we can judge the fruit, but we can't judge the heart. Now, the question is, how do I know if I'm judging, you know, condemning someone, or if I'm just discerning the fruit in their life? How do I tell the difference? Well, a practical application. Remember in John chapter 13, it's the time of the Last Supper, and what Jesus does is he wraps a towel around his waist and he grabs a bowl of water and he goes around and begins to sit at each disciple's feet and wash their feet. And of course, you know, they're all looking around going, what's this? What's going on? And most of them are afraid to say anything, of course, you know, except for good old Peter, who says, Lord, it shall never be. You'll never wash my feet. And Jesus says, well, if I don't wash your feet, you know, then you won't be clean. And Peter says, well, then give me a bath. You know, dunk me. Give me a whole shower. Scrub me down. You know, and Jesus says, no, you don't need that. You've already been cleansed. You just need to have your feet cleansed. Because as you walk, it's your feet that come into contact with the world, and they're going to collect dirt and gunk, you know, and muck. And it's only it only makes sense that needs to be washed off when you come in the house. Now, the difference for us is, if we just walk around looking at, you know, who has dirty feet, dirty feet, like we're the feet police. Well, we're just condemning. That guy has dirty feet. He can't come in. In fact, that's literally what happened at the original Calvary Chapel down in Costa Mesa, California. It's one of Pastor Chuck's favorite stories when he and his wife Kay would go down to the beach and they would minister to the hippies in the late 1960s. And these are kids who, young teenagers, mostly into their early 20s, and they had, you know, left home and they were just living on the beach. You can do that in Southern California. You know, you can just sleep in the sand because it doesn't get that cold. And they would, however, they would feed themselves, but they didn't have access to showers and bathtubs. And so after a while, you know, they get kind of grungy. And Kay and Chuck would go down and minister to these kids on the beach. I think it was Newport Beach. And then they'd invite them to church. You know, the kids would raise their hand and they'd receive Jesus as their Lord and Savior. And they'd invite them, come over to our church. And then the kids, lo and behold, they showed up by the hundreds. And they walked in the church with those dirty feet. A lot of them didn't even own shoes. It was kind of cool then not to wear shoes or other certain garments. Carla knows what I'm talking about. But kind of the old guard at the church, and these are, you know, well-meaning, well-intended people that loved the Lord, but they loved the Lord, but they also kind of loved the carpet. And they said, we can't let those dirty, stinky kids in here. Their feet are staining the carpet. And Chuck said, is that right? Well, then, tell you what we'll do. We'll come down here and we'll pull that carpet out of there so it won't be a problem anymore. Some of the people were doing exactly what Jesus says not to do. They were condemning the whole person because their feet were dirty. And Chuck was said, hey, you know, we're in the business of feet washing. Jesus says, I don't want you to be the feet police. In fact, I think the message tied in with John 13 is, don't point out dirty feet unless you're willing to bend down and wash them. Judge not that you be not judged. Judge not so that you won't be judged. For, Bible students, you see the word for, it means he's going to explain. With what judgment you judge, you will be judged. And with the measure you use, it will be measured back to you. What he's saying here is that we'll all be judged by our own standards. We're all going to be measured with our own yardstick. Judged by God? No, that's not what he's talking about here. All my sins have been dealt with at the cross. That judgment, as far as sheep and goats, heaven and hell, eternity, that's settled. Well, if not by God, then by who? Well, he's talking about judging one another. We judge one another, and we're going to be judged, he says, by others with the same measure, the same yardstick that we use to judge them. But if I go around pointing out dirty feet, then that means that people are going to look, well, your feet are dirty too. See, that same standard of judgment that you use. And there's a really good example of this principle of being judged by the same standard you judge others. A really good example of that is over in Judges chapter 1. Real quickly, turn back over there, if you will. Right after Joshua, Joshua judges Ruth. It's a complete sentence with those three names of the Bible. It's also a Lyle Lovett album title, by the way, but that's not pertinent. Judges chapter 1. Now, this is kind of an unusual story, but it illustrates the point really well. After the death of Joshua, it came to pass that the children of Israel asked the Lord, saying, who shall be first to go up for us against the Canaanites to fight against them? And the Lord said, Judah, you know, the tribe of Judah, shall go up. Indeed, I have delivered the land into his hand. So Judah said to Simeon, his brother, come up with me to my allotted territory that we may fight against the Canaanites, and I'll likewise go with you to your allotted territory. And Simeon went with him. You know, it's, come on, bro, help me fight my fight, and I'll help you fight yours. So far, so good. Then Judah went up, and the Lord delivered the Canaanites and the Perizzites into their hand, and they killed 10,000 men at Bezek. And they found Adonai Bezek, that's a guy. They found Adonai Bezek in Bezek and fought against him, and they defeated the Canaanites and the Perizzites. Then Adonai Bezek fled, and they pursued him and caught him and cut off his thumbs and big toes. What? Oh yeah, big battle going on. Two, you know, Judah and Simeon, two armies joined together fighting the Canaanites tooth and nail. It's life and death. And they finally catch this guy and they cut off his thumbs and big toes. We'll keep reading. And Adonai Bezek said, 70 kings with their thumbs and big toes cut off used to gather scraps under my table as I have done so God has repaid me. You know, it's what goes around comes around. As you sow, shall you reap. As you judge, that's the way you'll be judged. What are you critical of about people? Well, I just don't like the way she looks. Well, guess how you're going to be judged? I just don't like the way he talks. Guess how you're going to be judged? Well, I just don't like their attitude. I don't like the way they live. I don't like the way they raise their kids. I don't like the way they drive. I don't like the way they dress. I don't like what they eat, you know, as if it was any of your business. I don't like what they drink. I don't like what they smoke or don't smoke or if they smoke. I don't, you know, but the same judgment that you, that scares me. It really does. I mean, the Lord's working on me. All praise the Lord for it. But man, I remember the time when, you know, it was just like, you're a loser. You're a winner. You're a winner. I can hang out with you. You can hang out with me. But oh, that guy, that gal, those people. Oh, I remember the night the Lord really broke my heart of that. They had just opened card rooms in La Center. They moved them all up from downtown Vancouver. Vancouver kicked them out because they wanted a bunch of empty buildings, I guess. And they moved, so the card guys moved up. They got the legislation to get approved, and they set up business in La Center. And I, at that time, was a full-time professional musician, and somebody called me up, said, hey, do you want to come play? And I said, yeah, that's what I do. I need the money. You know, a job's a job, and well, it's up in La Center at this card room. Okay, I don't care, card room, schmard room. I, you know, showed up with all my stuff and my funny pants and my funny shirt and got up and started to sing and play and do my thing. And I remember looking out at all those losers. Those guys were gambling and smoking and drinking, and guys were trying to meet girls, and girls were trying to meet guys, and they weren't necessarily wanting to get married, but they wanted to go on a honeymoon just the same. And I'm just looking at them going, oh, you scumbags, you dirty dog devils, you know. And then as I'm in the middle of some song, the Lord just, I was a fairly new believer at that time, and the Lord just kind of smacked me and said, hey, you moron, what makes you so different from these people? Oh, you don't smoke? Ooh, you know, really impressed. You don't drink alcohol? Ooh, you know, big deal. Look at you. Look what you do. If I'm judged by the same standard I was using to judge all them, we're all on that bobsled to hell without any hope. Now, of course, the point is we were all on the bobsled to hell without any hope unless and until we kind of open up our eyes to the gospel and who Jesus is and what he's done and what he offers. But this idea of being such a judgmental person, you know, if you go around cutting off thumbs and big toes, then you guess what? You can expect that from other people. Now, verse 3. And why do you look, this is an example of the principle he just stated, why do you look at the speck in your brother's eye, but don't consider the plank in your own eye? You know, there's a sliver in your brother's eye, but you've got a telephone pole in your eye. So how are you going to, you know, how can you say to your brother, let me help you with that sliver when you have a telephone pole in your own eye? The speck and the plank, you know, the sliver and the telephone pole are all made of the same stuff. And what he's talking about here is sin. It's easy to recognize your sin when it's the same sin that I'm guilty of. Oh, nothing irritates me more than somebody just like me. Really? Really? You big, dumb jerk. Don't you realize you don't have enough hair to do that? You know? It's so easy. See, what bugs me about you is probably what bugs me about me. And you can turn that around. In fact, you know that old line, it's not a joke, but the old line, when you point one finger that way, there's three more pointing back at you. Well, that's really true. And that's the principle he's talking about here. It's so easy to judge others and then we forget that we have our own stuff in the way. How can I see your sin, the sliver in your eye, when I can't see around this plank, this telephone pole in my own eye? You know, that was what busted King David big time. He fights battles and he wins wars, and finally it comes a point in his life where he's just staying home at the castle, Jerusalem. And his army is out doing battle. But the king, you know, he's done his fair share, and after all, he's the king. And he kind of strolls around late one evening about sunset, you know, at dusk, and outside on the walkway, and he kind of looks over and he says, "What's that?" It's Bathsheba, appropriately named because she's taken a bath. And King David likes what he sees, even though he's got wives and concubines. And so he sends somebody, "Go bring her. Bring her over to me." Well, she doesn't have any choice. The king summons you, you go. Anyway, long story short, now David and Bathsheba are going to be parents. Problem is, Bathsheba's still married to Uriah, who's out on the battlefield fighting David's battle for him. David's got a problem now. Oh man, I've got this married gal in a family way, and I'm the king, and this isn't going to look good. So he sends a messenger down to the battlefield and says, "Put Uriah out on the front line," knowing full well that when they do that, Uriah is going to die in battle. And that's what happens. Uriah dies, and then David marries Bathsheba, who's been widowed. And now, you know, the time span is such that there's like, well, I guess this could be, you know, okay, I buy it. This is David's baby. And then Nathan the prophet comes to David, and he says, "David, there was this guy, and he owned flocks, herds of sheep, as far as you could see, sheep. Hundreds of sheep. And his friends came over and he wanted to throw them a party and he wanted to serve up, you know, some mutton chops or something, some sheep. And so rather than take one of his own sheep, he went to his neighbor who only had one sheep. And he took that sheep, exercised his authority as king to take what he wants, took that sheep, slaughtered it, and fed it to his friends. Now, David, what are we going to do with this guy?" And David's just outraged. "This man must die. You know, this is unacceptable." And then Nathan pulls the punchline. "David, I'm talking about you." "Me?" "Uriah had one precious wife. He's just a soldier. You're the king of all Israel, and you have flocks of women. You have what?" David had 10 wives that we know of, and who knows how many concubines in a harem. And here's David ready to just condemn this guy in the story when actually it's his own self. He was pointing the one finger and the three were pointing back at him. Now, David is a man of such character, though, rather than say, "Well, no, I didn't. Well, no, let me explain. You don't understand. Let me tell you how it really went down. This is what really happened. And I went, and she said that she didn't tell me she was married." And, you know, and lies and explanations and justifying the whole thing. Instead, David wrote this in Psalm 51. "Against you and you only have I sinned, Lord." See, he acknowledged his own sin. At first, he wanted to judge someone else who was guilty of the same thing. But then when he realized, oh, they're talking about me. That's my story. You know, with the measure you judge, that's what you'll be measured with. And the plank in David's eye prevented him from seeing the truth until Nathan kind of knocked the plank out of the way for a minute and said, "David, take a close look." And David was truly convicted. You know, he's just saying here that we need to deal with our own sin so we can see clearly. That's the thing. You have to deal with our own sin. And the thing is, you might think, well, once I get this plank out of my eye, now we're in business. I got my magnifying glass. I'm looking for splinters. I'm going to help everybody I can. No, you know, the thing is, once you get the plank out of your own eye, you're so much less likely to condemn anybody else. Because you begin to see people the way the Lord sees you. As a sinner. As a person with no hope when it comes to attaining or achieving or deserving a right standing before God our Creator. But then, worth, so much to God that he would become one of us, live the way we live, suffer a torturous and murderous death, and then rise from the dead as promised, as prophesied, so that anyone and everyone who just takes him at his word, we need to deal with our own sin so we can see clearly, so that we don't do more harm than good. How many of you would go to a surgeon knowing that he was going to wear a blindfold? Nobody? Well, I wouldn't. But see, that's kind of what we do. We declare ourselves surgeons, although we have blindfolds on and we attempt to do surgery. Let me help you with that. Let me fix that little problem you've got. You know, I recognize in you a certain character flaw. And me, you know, I love you so much. And by the grace of God and the power of the Spirit, I'm going to just call upon myself to become your big brother and your mentor and your counselor. Well, wait a minute. Thanks a lot, pal, but I have a counselor. He's called the Holy Spirit of God. And I appreciate your concern, but you know, why don't you go look in the mirror and take that blindfold up and maybe work on your own eye a little bit. David in Psalm 51 said, "Create in me a pure heart and renew a steadfast spirit within me." I love that song. "Create in me a pure heart, O God, and renew a right spirit within me." And then in down a couple of verses, he says, then I'll teach transgressors your way. First, create in me a purify my heart, Lord. Forgive my sin. Help me get that plank out of my eye. Renew a steadfast spirit within me, a heart after the things of God. And then, after we settle that, then I'll teach transgressors your way. It's not our job to judge. We're not called. We're not qualified. In verse 6, we learn that it's discernment, not judgment, that's needed. It's identification, not condemnation. Now, this verse is one of those verses that I think a lot of Christians or even non-Christians are familiar with. But I think too often we lose sight of how it fits in the context, in the flow of this whole idea about judgment. Verse 6, he says, "Do not give what is holy to the dogs, nor cast your pearls before swine, lest they trample them under their feet and turn and tear you to pieces." Now, too often, we read that verse and say, well, what does that have anything to do with judge, don't judge, you know, planks and specs and measures and all that stuff? Well, really, it just completes the idea. Let's try to hear this verse the way these disciples would have heard it as Jesus spoke to them. Don't give what is holy. What is holy? NIV, I think, uses the word sacred. We get that idea. It's what Psalm 119 refers to again and again as the wonderful things of God. Don't give the wonderful things of God to dogs, or cast your pearls, another synonym for those wonderful things, before swine. Well, who are the dogs and who are the swine? What's he talking about here? The dogs and the swine in this teaching would refer not to unbelievers so much as anyone that's hostile to the gospel. Now, that would include unbelievers. I hope there's no believers that are hostile to the gospel, but it's not the unbelieving part that is the problem here. It's that hostility, that hard-heartedness to the gospel. See, we've got on the one hand, we've got brothers and sisters who we see making mistakes, and we judge, oh, if you keep doing that, brother, you're not going to go to heaven. If you keep doing that, sister, you're going to be in big trouble. So we take it upon ourselves to perform surgery while our blindfold is on, and we do more harm than good. And then on the other hand, we look at the unbelieving world, and what do we do with them? Too often we try to cram the truth down their throat, whether they want to hear it or not. There used to be this guy, what's it, Preacher Bob. And when I was in high school, I'd take the bus over to Portland to see Mary, and the transfer always happened right downtown, like 5th and Yamhill. And there was this guy by the old courthouse in Portland. I don't know what his name was. We all called him Preacher Bob because he stood there with a megaphone, you know, and he would, as the bus went by, "You're all going to burn. You're going to go to hell. If you don't change the way you're living, you're not going to go." And it was, you know, who's going to go, oh, sign me up, Bob? You know, but he was so, I mean, rightly motivated. It kind of reminds me of the Apostle Paul, you know, whose zeal for the Lord actually inspired him or prompted him to do in God's people. Here's a guy who wants so badly to save the lost that he's going to shout virtual curses on them. Now, he was right. If you don't turn, you do burn. You know, if you don't get right, you do get left. But to kind of yell it through a megaphone in somebody's face when they aren't even interested, I mean, that's what he's talking about here. The dogs and the pigs. Turn, to clarify this, turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 4. Just up a little bit, past the Gospels, Acts, Romans, 1 Corinthians, 2 Corinthians, chapter 4. Even if our gospel is veiled, it's veiled to those who are perishing, whose minds the God of this age, that would be Satan, who is alive and well on planet Earth, has blinded, who do not believe, lest the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God, should shine on them. You know, there's the unbelievers have been blinded to the truth. Where's the verse? I didn't make a note of it, but you hopefully will remember it, where it's the verse that says, you know, the truth of God is foolishness to those who don't believe. And that's what Jesus talks about, casting your pearls before us. When you take the precious gospel, the life-changing, the life-saving gospel, that there's salvation by grace alone, through faith alone, in Jesus Christ alone, and you just kind of throw it down in the mud for the pigs to walk on. Because the pigs aren't interested. It takes a little discernment to know. Now, God has a heart for evangelism. Don't take this too far. But there's a sense of well, there's not only, there's gifting, and there's a sense of leading that the Spirit, you know, has to do. I mean, I've seen well-intentioned people who are kind of whipped up into an emotional evangelistic frenzy by someone else, and they're going to go, by golly, and they are going to knock on doors, and they're going to just confront people with the truth about their nasty, wicked lifestyle and give them the opportunity to get right, you know, because if you don't get right, you're going to get left, and they forget their megaphone, their bullhorn. But it's the same thing, and it does more harm than good. It does more harm. Well, I'm just going out to share the gospel. The Lord told me, be prepared to give an answer. Well, but to give an answer, somebody has to ask a question. To receive, somebody has to have an open heart. See, when you're sharing the gospel, you're talking about here pearls before swine and treasures before dogs. When you're talking about sharing the gospel with someone who is hostile to the gospel, then you probably don't want to start the conversation by interpreting end times prophecy. You know what I mean? Or eternal security. Or trying to understand the mystery of the Trinity. Probably not a good place to start. But how about you start with the love that led Jesus to the cross? How about you start with explaining or sharing about your experience with God's grace that accepts you not because of anything about you, but in spite of everything about you. It's not your job to judge. It is your job to love. To love the Lord so that conviction and confession for your own sin lead to a celebration over your restoration. To love other believers so that instead of I got you, it's I've got your back. I got you covered. I'm here to help. I'm not here to hurt. I'm here to bless you. I'm not here to bust you. I'm here to build you up, not tear you down. To love the Lord, to love believers, to love the unsaved, so that the gospel is declared, is shouted by the way you live all day, every day, being sensitive to the leading of the Spirit. which only comes as you grow in your personal relationship with the Lord. See, even if you can't approve of the things that someone might do or the way that someone might live, maybe you can't approve, but you can definitely still love them. And if you do, if you do your job, that makes it easier for the Lord to do his job. And when he does his job, it makes it easier for you to do your job, and it's not your job to judge. That's what Jesus wants you to know.